If you would, grab a Bible, turn it to Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31. If you like to follow along in the particular translation I'm using, I am using the Christian Standard Bible translation. And so if you'd like to grab one there at the back of the room in baskets on the floor underneath the light switches, you will want the black colored Bible. The black colored Bible, that's the CSB. Proverbs 31. I will either be concluding the series in Proverbs that we've been going through on again, off again over the last few months, or I will be doing the second to the last message today. I'm not sure which yet. I may do one more message in Proverbs before the summer is out, but I'm for sure wanted to get this one in before we move on to some other things, more specifically into 1 Corinthians. Starting next week, we're going to continue what we did last summer. We're just going to pick up right where we left off. And I'll catch those of you who are not aware of what we did last summer. I'll try and do my best to catch you up as well. Proverbs 31, though, a few quick things to keep in mind about this particular proverb. There are two sections to Proverbs 31. They were probably meant to be two sections. It is probably difficult to make a hard case that they are absolutely, without question, linked to one another, these two separate poems. Having said that, it's probably okay to think that there's at least something to them being linked together into one chapter, that they aren't completely without connection, and it's not completely insignificant that they were put together in the scriptures. Something else about these passages that might be interesting for you to know and might explain a few things to you. This is lost on our English translations, by the way. In the Hebrew alphabet, this is actually an acrostic poem. And I specifically mean once you get to verse 10 through verse 31. The part that most people think of when they think of Proverbs 31, the part about the noble or valiant wife. It is an acrostic poem, and that is important because the idea is that he is trying, the author of the poem, presumably in this way is the husband, he's trying to be comprehensive to the degree that you can ever truly be exhaustive about such things, in naming everything or as much as he can muster from A to Z regarding his wife. So it's not so much that this was all he could think of, but he's actually being poetic and thinking of something that matches each letter of the Hebrew alphabet, while at the same time, in the spirit of that, mentioning all that he can think of from A to Z regarding his wife. And then finally, and this might help connect some dots for a few of you who are aware of other parts of the Bible, but in the Hebrew Bible, which I don't know if you know this, but in the Hebrew Bible, they don't categorize all the books the same way we do in our English Bibles. And by the way, there's nothing that interferes with the Bible's meaning by doing that or by categorizing them differently. But you need to know that in the Hebrew Bible, they do different orders of books as well, and that there's probably rhyme and reason to how the order of these particular books went. You see, the Proverbs 31 woman, as she's known in Proverbs 31, is followed up by the Bible book of Ruth. And so they really, in that order, that's intentional, and some of the same words used about the Proverbs 31 woman in Hebrew are used specifically to Ruth as well. And so Ruth is something of an unpacking of what this looks like in real life. And then following up on Ruth is Song of Songs. If you don't know anything about Song of Songs, it's an incredibly sexually explicit book of the Bible, so much so that young Hebrew men were not allowed to read it until they reached a certain age because of its material. And so it's an interesting logical progression from the end of Proverbs to Ruth to Song of Songs. speaking about the full scope of not only this woman and her husband, but also speaking of the larger picture of men and women relating to one another, and then, of course, on a more specific level, husbands and wives relating to one another. Okay, with all that said, let's go ahead and look at the text. We're going to be starting in verse 1. A lot of times you don't see that happen when you get into Proverbs 31. You go immediately to 10. But we're going to go ahead and treat it like it's not a mistake that they're grouped together completely. Okay, so verse 1. The words of King Lemuel, a pronouncement that his mother taught him. So real quickly, just so that we're keeping track of things, it is likely that most of the Proverbs were collected and put into an anthology that we call Proverbs in the Bible by King Solomon. Not all of them probably, because we have some dating issues if that were the case, but most of them were, and we ascribe for the most part Proverbs to Solomon. So this is Solomon quoting King Lemuel of Massa, who is in turn quoting his mom in the instructions that she gave him. So it's a little bit of third-hand information, but nonetheless, important things being said here. A pronouncement that his mother taught him. What should I say, my son? What, son of my womb? What, son of my vows? Don't spend your energy on women, or your efforts on those who destroy kings. And so he's being specific here. He's not saying don't spend your time on women, period, because obviously that would be ridiculous, because you would obviously want to spend time with your spouse. But he's saying the kind of women that destroy kings. Do not spend or obsess your world around that kind of a woman. It is not for kings, Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to desire beer. And he's not talking about complete abstinence here so much as he is saying an unhealthy obsession, even what we would call alcoholic obsession with alcoholic beverages. He says, do not be the one who desires in an unhealthy way these kinds of things, gets inebriated, drunk, all those kinds of things. Otherwise, he will drink and forget what is decreed. That's obviously talking about inebriation or drunkenness. He will forget what is decreed. Continuing on, and pervert justice as a result for all the oppressed. In other words, his decision-making faculties will leave him. He won't think straight. He won't think properly about things. Give beer to the one who is dying, and wine to those whose life is bitter. Let him drink so that he can forget his poverty and remember his troubles no more. This is likely sarcasm. This is not prescriptive. This is not saying, hey, anyone who's bitter, anyone who's suffering, give him this stuff, get him sloshed. That's not probably what the Bible is teaching here. It's being sarcastic that if you're not the kind of person who would even hint of having to need these things. There are others who have more of a temptation towards these things on a physical level than you do. But, as we'll see in a minute, a lot of the temptation for these kinds of things aren't of a physical nature so much as they are of a heart and emotional nature specific to King Lemuel or to kings in general. Continuing on, speak up for those who have no voice, for the justice of all who are dispossessed. Speak up, judge righteously, and defend the cause of the oppressed and the needy. So, a king would have an abundance of money, an abundance of power and influence, an abundance of discretionary time. Or time that he owns that other people don't own for him. And because of those things, they all sit as gifts, but also as great potential temptations for those who have them, and will only increase temptations in the arenas that she addresses, both in the arena of sex and sexuality and the arena of alcohol. whether it is utilizing or leveraging these areas for distraction, pleasure, escape, whatever it is, for whatever reason, the gateway to those things are far more likely, far more open, far more tempting when one has power and influence, money, and discretionary time. Now, in those days, that describes either a ruler or a king like Lemuel, or it describes one of noble birth or one of significant business wealth. But rarely throughout history does it describe most people in most places, except where we live, except for here. In the West, historically speaking, culturally speaking, we're kings. You might as well insert your name if you're a man in this room, because we, as a society, have more power and influence, have more money, financial means, and resources. We have more discretionary time. Oh, yeah, I know. You're going to make the case for how you're so busy, right? You're busy because you make yourself busy most time. But we truly have more discretionary time than most cultures and societies have had. Do we really want to account for all the minutes we use doing things that have no productivity value at all? You'll see you have a lot of discretionary time, and so do I. And so this is actually very, very much keyed in on you and I in our culture and our time. These same temptations that King Lemuel has. And whatever of all the particulars, the emphasis here is that with increasing resources, which we have in the West as well, just like a king in those days, with increasing stewardship comes increasing responsibility. Responsibility. She's trying to get that message across to her son. Be responsible. Don't do the things that lead to you being irresponsible. Why? Because people depend on you. People depend on you. Now, right here from the beginning, we got to say this. For those who recognize Proverbs 31, who know anything of Proverbs 31, we have to admit that much of what people think of when they think of Proverbs 31 is the Proverbs 31 woman. And so we should be taken aback a little here to recognize and just admit out loud, Proverbs 31 starts with men. And it starts with men who have influence, power, money, and time. And it says, you as a man, before anything is said about women, you as a man, be a responsible man, because people depend on you. If you're doing manhood right, people depend on you. Be responsible. Furthermore, she says, be disciplined. Don't let these things own you. Don't let the kind of woman that destroys kings and sexuality, and alcohol, don't let those things destroy you. Be a disciplined man. Know how to say no. Know how to turn away. Know how to run. And finally, with these resources and stewardship at his fingertips, comes increasing need for his character and integrity to be amazing. To pursue the kind of character and integrity that allows him to be a good king, a good father, a good husband, a good leader of a household, a good leader in your community or at your workplace. With increasing stewardship comes increasing responsibility, discipline, and the need for character integrity to be key to the core of who you are. Additionally, each of these areas are increasingly neglected when one actually abuses and uses things like alcohol or one's sexuality in a way it was never meant to be used. Now, we get to the passages that many of us think of when we consider Proverbs 31 once we get to verses 10 through 31. And I have much to say about these. These passages have much to say to us, but we are going to keep it to two big messages for today. Two big messages, and I'll get into some minutia, but I want you to hear these two big messages throughout this text. The first is this. Proverbs 31, while it is poetry, it is a teaching poem. It is meant to teach. All of Proverbs is meant to give wisdom and to teach a young man from his father. It is meant to teach. It does have many real life and many tangible or actionable implications that are worth us exploring. Okay? So we're not just going to ignore what it says and only treat it in the big sense. We will get into the minutiae, the details of what it has to teach us. But secondly, I want you to know that this passage, and this may be new to some of you once we get into it, and it may be the most significant thing you walk away from here, and that is this. Proverbs 31 is deeply, deeply theological. People don't immediately recognize that when they come to it, but it is deeply theological. And it wants to have its way in this way for us. It wants to have a broad impact on our worldview and how we think about the nature of human relationships, the nature of how we think about gender, manhood, womanhood, and it wants us to think about the nature of the church's role as what the Bible calls Jesus' bride. We are called Jesus' bride, and that is significant, and there are theological implications to reading this in light of that. Okay? So with that being said, first of all, we need to understand that Proverbs 31, in being a teaching poem, is going to teach us something about the perspective of what a father should want his son to know. Therefore, since it is this teaching poem, and the many implications it may give us that we can walk away for, we must consider it from that perspective. We cannot ignore that this is a father writing to his son. That has implications for how you read it. So as we read through it, I'll be sharing some reflections along the way. You just follow along with me and ask yourself questions as we go along in the sense of knowing that this is a father writing to his son. Does not mean it's not for women. This was meant for all people. It just means you need to understand the immediate context to understand how it applies to a much broader context. Does that make sense, guys? Okay, yeah? Nods, yes? Okay, good. Let's go. Verse 10. Who can find a wife of noble character? She's far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will not lack any good thing. She rewards him with good, not evil, all the days of her life. First reflection is this. A noble woman of character, as she's called, has the complete trust and confidence of her husband. She is undoubtedly his equal, created in the image and likeness of God. So, recentering us on the context again, if that is true, that this is from a father to a son, we need to understand that this father wants his son to understand that he, as his father, trusts his mother implicitly. That it is good to trust your wife as your equal, made in the image and likeness of God. Second reflection, look at verse 13. She selects wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the merchant ships bringing her food from far away. She rises while it is still night, and she provides food for the household and portions for her female servants. She evaluates a field, she buys it. She plants a vineyard with her earnings. She draws on her strength, and she reveals that her arms are strong. She sees that her profits are good, and her lamp never goes out at night. She extends her hands to the spinning staff, and her hands hold the spindle. Her hands reach out to the poor. She exceeds and extends her hands to the needy. She is not afraid for her household when it snows, for all in her household are doubly clothed. She makes her own bed coverings. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known at the city gates, where he sits among the elders of the land. And she makes and sells garments, linen garments. She delivers belts to the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she can laugh at the time to come. It's two interesting statements we've already read in there. It's not the only thing interesting, but just two interesting statements. She's not afraid for her household when it snows, for her household are doubly clothed. That means she basically planned in advance so anxiety would not be something she borrowed. And then later on it says she can laugh at the time to come. These feel really hard to live up to as women, as moms, as sisters, as daughters, because it paints a picture of a woman that's not really that anxious. Yet anxiety cripples so many women. Anxiety over their kids, which, by the way, Genesis chapter 2 said that's a part of the fall. That her heart will be wrenched out for her children, those who she bears. And that is a effect of sin. But if it kind of takes you to a dark place to imagine the fact that this woman is utterly unanxious and you are so far to the opposite, stick with me. There's good news yet to come in this text. Finishing off this section, her mouth speaks wisdom, verse 26, and loving instruction is on her tongue. She watches over the activities of her household and is never idle. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Moms, true question. How often do your kids rise up in the morning and say, "You're blessed"? I'm blessed for having you, Mom. Oh, man, the checklists just aren't getting checked, are they? So this second reflection, she's a woman of action. She's a woman, if you want to get even more specific, of productivity. A woman of productivity. Which brings up an aspect again of Genesis chapter 1. That we were made in the image and the likeness of God. Men and women, we were made in the image and likeness of God. And a part of that likeness is that we were made to be productive workers. Friends, we were made in that image and likeness to be productive workers long before Genesis 2 and the fall in sin came about. We were meant to be productive. And so he's making sure you understand his wife is productive. This woman's husband truly views her as Genesis 2 calls her, his helper. Helper is not a derogatory term, by the way. In fact, the scriptures called God our helper on a couple of occasions, in fact. And so if you want to call that derogatory or insulting, then you have to make the theological case that the Bible is insulting God. God insulting himself, calling himself the helper to us. That's a quandary that I don't think that we can get past. And the logical conclusion is that a helper is a noble and good thing. Because it also emphasizes that Genesis 1, she is a part of his likeness and image in God, that she is the completeness, that before she came along, man by himself, it was not good that he be the lone created human being, because he alone could not image Father, Son, and Spirit properly or completely. The woman had to also be there for there to be a completeness of the Father, Son, and Spirit image and likeness that we were meant to have as a people, as a society. And so she is being extolled as being exactly that. Her productivity makes the case that she is helper exemplar, the ultimate helper, the best helper you can imagine. She's not an accessory or a tag-along, but his partner and helper in carrying out God's mission in ways to the ends of the earth. And he's naming the ways in which she engages in the many responsibilities of their household and their business ventures, the way that she lives out the call to be productive, work-like image bearers for God in this world, extending his glory as far and wide as possible, and being a positive influence and a good to the rest of humanity. This is the description he's giving to his wife. Verse 29, many women have done noble deeds. That's an important statement to make. It's a truthful statement to make. Being godly is not the arena of exclusivity when it comes to noble deeds. There are many ungodly, many dispassionate, disinterested, irreligious people who do noble deeds. To believe otherwise is foolish. There's a lot of good and noble deeds that get done by people who are very far from God. And he just wants to make that case, whether they know the Lord, trust the Lord, or whether they don't trust the Lord, don't believe in God. Many women have made noble deeds, but he wants you to understand this. You, he's speaking to his wife, surpass them all. You surpass them all. Charm is deceptive. Beauty is fleeting. But a woman who fears the Lord will be praised. What is he saying here? Well, this is the third reflection. His ultimate or climactic praise or words that he has regarding his wife is for her character. For her character. Her character that flows from the fact that she fears and trusts the Lord and does it without apology and without question. He cannot help but make this the climactic statement in this passage. Charm is deceptive. Beauty is fleeting. Because he hadn't said anything about her beauty. He hadn't said anything about her charm. But a woman who really fears the Lord and all her noble deeds, the reason why you surpass them all her needs, her noble deeds flow from there. She is to be praised. And the fourth and final reflection. This woman is, in fact, just as he said she's deserved of praise, he praises his wife then. Verse 31, give her the reward of her labor. Let her works praise her at the city gates. In other words, that's a way of saying at the city gates where he gathers with the rest of the leaders of the community, make sure they know about how she's awesome. That they know of her great deeds that should be praised, that should be talked about. People know her reputation. Even if they don't notice it, even if they don't pick up on her reputation on her own, they're going to hear about her reputation because her husband's going to make sure people know what he thinks about his wife. She's praised by her husband. Her husband gives her credit, declares that all that which she has rewarded and commended is deserved. This is something of a summary statement of all that has occurred in these verses, because he has been praising her all along. The reason he can praise her is that he actually knows her. He actually knows who she is. Take you back in time to the days when you're in high school or college and you would sign other people's yearbooks or they would sign yours. You know the signatures I just despised in yearbooks? Hey, had a great time getting to know you. You're a real nice guy. What does that mean? I'm a nice guy. I don't know. You're just a nice guy. It's been good to know you. Do you really know me if you think I'm nice and you can't really talk to me about how nice I am? And my wife, flat out, had all kinds of people would write things like, you're so sweet. And she says, I am not sweet. She's very self-aware. She's not sweet. She can be sweet, just like any of us, but she would tell you that is not her lead foot. She's no nonsense, take charge, say truth. She's like, you don't know me. This guy knows his wife. This guy knows his wife. He's studied her. He's truly considered all that she is to him. This is an important reflection that deserves consideration if you haven't considered it before. Because more than anything, these verses might have to say to the woman who maybe is reading this and to a woman that is reading this, this poem, again, is primarily to a young man and reminds him and us of the importance of knowing your wife. He wants his son to eavesdrop on what he has to say about his mom so he knows that his son knows that I know your mom. And I've taken notice of her. And I've studied her enough that I can say things about her. And I can extol her and praise her. I've done a discipleship group with a group of guys a couple years ago. I actually made it an assignment. But some of you, if you want to do this at some point, maybe about a woman in your life, it can be your wife, it could be your mom, it can be just maybe a woman you have significant respect for, maybe your sister, whatever it is, you can actually write your own Proverbs 31. Just don't call it the Bible, right? Because that's heresy. But you can do this. You can write your own proverb about your wife as just an exercise in how much you know your wife, how much you can speak in expertise terms about her, how much you can praise her. Because truly, if I were to write a Proverbs 31 about my wife, and hopefully this disarms Proverbs 31 to many of you. If I had to write one about my wife, it would not look anything like this. And it wouldn't look anything like yours. Why? Because however you do this in the translation, the first verses of this section, who can find a wife of noble character? Some of the passages actually read a little bit different. They say, who can find an excellent wife? Or who can find a virtuous and capable wife? Capable, excellent, even whatever noble might look like, noble character, sometimes those things can be moving targets. Like they mean one thing in one context with one man. I am a different man than many of you. This man was a different man than me and you. And chances are, she is complimenting him in exactly the way that the Lord desires. And so it's something of a moving target in a good way, in that any Proverbs 31 you would have to write about someone in your life who is a lady would have to look different than what someone else writes. Okay? The point is that you know her, and not just some generality about women. You know her. There's also something else here, the importance of praising your wife and letting others know about her. I already mentioned it from verse 31, but I want to say one more thing about it. With all due respect to Ricky Bobby, referring to your wife as your smoking hot wife does not get the job done. At all. Stop. Or whatever the version of it that comes along culturally, that becomes the thing to say. Charm is deceptive, beauty is fleeting. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Speak of her instead how he trusts her as his equal. She is productive, and she is a fantastic helper. And how her character is by far the most attractive thing and important thing he can say about her. That's what this man is teaching his son. Make sure you can talk in terms about your future wife and women in your life as people that you can entrust and trust. and that you can actually say things about them that remind you how they're living out their God-likeness as a good helper, much like God helps us, and how they are, in fact, in their character, godly. Now, we need to conclude today with how Proverbs 31 is deeply theological, because like I said before, this might be the most significant or most important thing you have not considered about Proverbs 31 and how theologically it wants us to have a broad impact on our worldview and how we think about the nature of human relationships, gender, men and women, and the church's role as the bride of Jesus. So again, let me just provide some reflections on the theological nature of these verses. I'm not going to reread these verses. Hopefully, they're still in your mind since we've been dealing with them. So I'm not going to reread them, but we're going to reflect on a few things that I believe that in the text are meant to bend our hearts towards God's way of thinking about us, about one another, and the world. First reflection is this, and this comes more with contrasting Proverbs 31 with history and the contemporary literature of the culture of that day. But these verses, there's little question when you examine the literature of that time, little question that these verses are meant to be a counter or a foil to the views of wives and women, which largely centered on their charms and sexuality or their eroticism. That's what most men had to write about women. And this is an obvious counter to that. It's an obvious foil to say, that is one way to look, but this is the way that God intended us to look. The way that God intended us to view. Ladies. Also, it's a foil to what would eventually become the Hellenistic ideal. It doesn't really deal with it directly in this text, but the Hellenistic ideal, if you didn't know what it was far more stoic, far more intellectual or philosophical. A very heady thinking woman, much like many of the men of the day. Well, this woman here, she can instruct, but she's not just well-learned. She's not just well-learned. She's not simply a cold fish. In fact, this text, again, this is something that's lost in the English, but is definitely there in the Hebrew. Many commentators point out that it is hard to walk away from this, linguistically speaking, without understanding that this is meant to mimic what they call a heroic hymn, a poem of a hero. And there is war-like language used all and scattered throughout the text regarding the woman. Basically, she goes out, she considers a field, she buys it, she brings it home. The language in that you can't tell in the English is very much conquering language. She goes out, makes a conquer, brings home the spoils to home. So again, it kind of subverts our typical thinking on this, but nonetheless, he sees her as battling for their household. Battling for their family. She's not just a helper in productivity. She's a helper. She's going to war with him, knowing that the world can be a dangerous place, and it is a place where sin is rampant, and it's in my heart, it's outside in the world, and it also comes from an enemy of my soul. And she's in the battle with you. And this passage wants you to know, he thinks this woman's in the battle with him. For all of these things, that they are in war together. Second reflection. This is really, really important, especially when we get to the subject of gender and manhood and womanhood. There is a weight and significance given to one's God-given gender that should not be ignored from this text. And this includes both the basic relationships between men and women and the more intimate relationship between a husband and a wife. In other words, We each have roles, men and women. We have roles and parts that we are definitely playing that come from the image and likeness of God in this world. If you want to think of the world and its stage as a theater, we are all playing roles. We are all playing roles that feed into the likeness and image of God. And that's no different with men and women. Men and women are treated differently in the scriptures, not only because they're different biologically, because they were meant to image God in different ways, in complementary ways. But that is good. And that was a part of God's plan all along. And so for men, a big meta question, big picture question for you and I is this. If this is true, we need to ask ourselves the question constantly, how does Jesus treat us? How does he relate to us? Not just as men, but us collectively as his people, or as the Bible says, as his bride. How does he treat us? Our role then is to treat women, to speak of women and our wives in that manner. How does God speak of you? Does God speak of you in the ways you deserve? He doesn't, actually, when you've trusted Jesus. He speaks of you in amazing ways. Ways that, in your moments of honesty, say you don't deserve. You're playing a role. Treat women and your wives and your sisters and your daughters and your mothers like Jesus treats you, like he treats us. For women, knowing it is Jesus that truly makes us virtuous, knowing, let's just say for a minute, this is written about a real woman. And we're not sure that it really is, but let's say it is written about a real woman, not just an ideal woman. Does any woman ever live up to this 100% of the time? Could any woman? There's a right answer. What is it? No. But yet she's called virtuous. Virtuous. Who can find a wife of noble character? The cynical answer is no one. She doesn't exist. She's a myth. She's a unicorn. But yet, he goes on and calls her very much that in the words he uses, a woman of noble character. And so if we trust Jesus, the gospel is true for us, and a part of the gospel is that he calls us virtuous even when we're not. And the gospel tells us we're empowered by God the Holy Spirit as his followers to actually live out our beliefs, to actually live out the character God calls us. And so as women, you are given the gift of being able to image God to the rest of this world by walking in, by just doggedly battling to walk in your Christ-given virtue that he calls you. And praying the kinds of prayers that would enable you to look like those that have been actually empowered and blessed to be the hands and feet of Jesus. To truly reflect his character in all your ways. This is why the Bible is so harsh on women's speech. Because it is an arena in which you utterly display the antithesis, the opposite of godly character. Speaking rumors, innuendos, gossip, nasty, vitriolic terms to other women and to other people. Because that is not what he calls you. He calls you kind, fair, but also strong. Because the Spirit of God empowers you to live out the character that he calls you. Believe that. So, ladies, you will You need to declare in your heart, we will act as women of virtue or women. If we're not virtuous, we're something else. Women of promiscuity. I'm not talking about sexually, or at least not sexually alone. Meaning giving yourself over to all kinds of other things is what the Bible means by that. And so we're going to be one or the other, right? 3rd and final reflection, these passages are incredibly, in case you missed it, they are incredibly Christ-centered and gospel-rich. If you walk away from this with anything, I hope this is the thing you remember the most, is that this passage is gospel-rich and Christ-centered. After all, no woman, as we've already determined, truly matches the Proverbs 31 woman, nor does anyone ever live up to such press clippings, men or women. But isn't that the point? Isn't that the point of Proverbs 31 in passages like this? You see, the message of Proverbs 31 is the message of the Bible, the whole Bible. And that is the message of a husband who truly loves his bride. The Bible is a story of a husband who truly loves his bride with everything he is. Husband is Jesus. The Bible is about Jesus and his pursuit and love and redemption of his bride. This passage is but an echo of the message of Christ and his love for you and I, his people, his church. He doesn't just love us, he knows us. This is not simply about a man who knows his wife. This is about a God who knows us. Who loves you and knows you, who truly knows you, who knows the real you and calls you the virtuous you anyway. He calls us sons and daughters. He calls us treasured and precious. All the while, we know in terms used in the Bible, we are actually none of these things at all. In fact, in terms the Bible speaks of, we are spiritual prostitutes. We'll sell and give and be owned by all kinds of things. But he says, that's not who you are. Not really. But get this. And by the way, if you've never read the Bible book of Hosea, this is actually a part of the gospel message that comes from Hosea. He has Hosea marry a prostitute. Now, that's not prescriptive. That's not prescriptive for us to say, hey, it's okay if I marry a prostitute. God told Hosea to do that. That's not what Hosea is getting at. Hosea is a real-life illustration. He tells her because he's teaching them a very intimate object lesson. Hosea's wife goes off and she whores around all the time. But she eventually is brought back into the household and wooed back by her husband, but really by the gospel message. And she becomes the wife she was always intended to be and is a devoted wife. And she becomes all the things a wife should be, but hasn't been. Jesus chose not a perfect person, not a perfect bride, not the best of bad choices. Let's just say it straight. Jesus chose to make his bride one who is a prostitute. That's the message of Hosea. And it's a part of the message of we get here in Proverbs 31. And he did that. Made her his bride. Made her righteous because of his actions on the cross so that we don't have to be prostitutes anymore. Instead, we are given the gift of growing into the kinds of people, the kinds of men, the kinds of women that he says we already are as the gospel friends. That is the gospel. That is Proverbs 31.